Thank you all. I'd like to thank in particular Bill Campbell and Peter Schramm and the rest of the Philadelphia Society for inviting me here today. The last conference I attended was the American Political Science Association conference over Labor Day weekend, so it's nice to see a friendly and intelligent audience. I should also mention that I know that I am the 16th speaker of the day, if I think if my count's correct, so I think the one rule of rhetoric that I should follow is to keep it short. I am, as I said, however, a political scientist, which means I have absolutely no appreciation for or skill in rhetoric. So if you decide that you'd rather nod off during the next few minutes, please feel free to do so, and I will wake you up for Steve Hayward. Okay, my topic for today is a conservative defense of the rhetorical presidency. And I guess the first question you might be interested in is why do we need a conservative defense of the rhetorical presidency? And I think the reason is twofold. One, I can speak as a political scientist and say that the term rhetorical presidency within the literature of political science is not a term of approbation. It is a term of criticism. It is a term of criticism because the people who study the rhetorical presidency believe that what certain presidents have done is to remove the presidency as an office from its constitutional moorings. In the broader world, which doesn't take very much, the term rhetorical presidency is, I think, of concern because conservatives, as general, often distrust presidential power. And the reason for that is also a good one. The reason for that is that presidents can use rhetoric in order to undermine the limits that the Constitution tries to place on American government and politics. In fact, I would go even further than some of the comments made today in criticizing or raising suspicions about the rhetorical presidency. Our first speaker, my former professor Jim Caesar, I think was quite right to point out the dangers of demagogic rhetoric in the constitutional order. But the dangers are not just the dangers of rhetoric of fear or divisiveness. In fact, if you look at contemporary presidential rhetoric, I think the greater dangers are promises of what we're going to do for you. The idea that presidents are encouraged to increase their rhetorical power by promising things that they cannot deliver, which raise expectations, which undermine the legitimacy and belief that government is possible. The second form of rhetoric that I think is even more dangerous is empty rhetoric. And you stole my line here. What could be more empty than the phrase, "We are the ones we've been waiting for"? Now, I understand conservatives who are afraid of a Caesar or a Napoleon, but at least Caesar and Napoleon had some skills. You can admire certain aspects of Caesar and Napoleon. And you also know what you were fighting against, what you needed to destroy. How do you fight against, "We are the ones we've been waiting for"? It's like fighting against a mantra that's supposed to mesmerize an audience to follow a leader into the gates of hell. And I think it often works that way. So for all these reasons, I see the dangers of a rhetorical presidency and would very much agree with those who have criticized it. My concern has to do with the alternative. What is the alternative to the rhetorical presidency? Well, some have argued the best way to look at it is to try to put the president back into the constitutional office, that the president's rhetoric should be limited to ceremonial and constitutional rhetoric, that the president gets into trouble when the president begins to talk about policy. Policy is inevitably divisive. Policy leads to pandering. Presidents should be above that in some important respect. Okay, what if the president were? What does that leave us with? Well, the argument is it leaves us, or it leaves rhetoric with the branch of government that it was designed for. It leaves it with the deliberative branch of government, Congress. I'm not sure if that's supposed to be a laugh line, but Congress, it's argued, is the deliberative body. It is the safer body. Because in Congress, you have multiple voices. In Congress, you have the need for compromise. And in Congress, there is conversation and real deliberation possible, if not in the body as a whole, at least in committees or in subcommittees. So this is the positive view. Congress is really the alternative, and it's much safer, much better than the president. Now, some cynics look at this view of Congress and have questions about it. But even cynics often say it's better to leave it to Congress. Why is that? Because Congress is incompetent. You want Congress to be incompetent. Because if it's incompetent, it can only be so dangerous that you're not going to get the kind of dramatic policy initiatives, you're not going to get the kind of dramatic change with Congress. No one member is going to be able to mesmerize an audience. No one member has the legitimacy to claim that he speaks for the nation as a whole. And for those reasons, it is argued, Congress is simply safer. One member may try to do this, but 500 others will stand up and prevent him from doing so. Now, you've got two options then, or one option. You can have the presidency using rhetoric, or you can leave it to Congress, either because you think they're better at it or they're incompetent. I think both of those options, however, reflect a kind of utopianism about the character of Congress. In fact, I believe that a Congress by itself is not safe. A Congress by itself can be even more dangerous than a rhetorical president. In part because I believe that incoherence in government is not a substitute for restraint. Chaos is not restrained, and often that is what characterizes Congress. Multiple member bodies are less accountable than single member offices like the president. You can't hold a Congress accountable. You can hold a president accountable in a way Congress could never be. And without that kind of accountability, there is no internal mechanism that encourages the restraint of individual members of Congress. Finally, even if Congress doesn't undertake major projects, incremental change can be as dangerous or more dangerous. Incremental change makes it more difficult to rally public opinion in opposition. Incremental change often lets things increase gradually so that by the point anyone notices, the response is, well, this is the way we do things. This is the accepted practice. So for all of these reasons, I would argue Congress is not the solution, which takes me back to the little title of my paper, A Conservative Defense of a Rhetorical Presidency. I think the founders themselves actually understood the need for a rhetorical presidency. And I think you can see this in a number of places in the debates with the Constitution, even in the Federalist. But in particular, you can see it in the Constitution itself. And I'll just mention three quickly. One, the provisions for the State of the Union Address. Some critics of the rhetorical presidency have said, oh, this is a bad idea, it should be written, it should only go to Congress. But I think, in fact, the State of the Union Address was meant to be a time for a president to take a national perspective and present his view of the problems of the nation from a national perspective to Congress. It was the attempt to give the president an agenda-setting function in the constitutional system. Secondly, I think the idea of executive power is an essential part of a competent government. The founders created an independent executive because they believed executives would need to exercise discretion. And if they need to exercise discretion, they also will have to explain and defend its use. And this is an important rhetorical role for the president. And finally, the veto is in some ways is the most explicit. It's not just that the president can veto legislation, he also gives the reasons for his veto. And in this way, he helps to shape policy, sometimes before the fact, sometimes after the fact. I think you can see this if we just look at some of the major problems facing contemporary constitutional government. There are three areas I wanted to propose. One is the budget process, two is foreign policy, and three is moral leadership. In each case, I would say there is a crucial role for a constitutional rhetorical presidency. The budget process. No issue has more effect on public policy in the United States than the federal budget. And no problem is more important to the United States than the current size of the federal budget deficit. Is Congress capable of dealing with it? The answer is no. Members of Congress will talk about balanced budget amendments, but the fact is, after 40 years of talking about balanced budget amendments, we don't even have a budget this year. If you're going to ensure accountability, there has to be something there. And the only time we have seen serious accountability on budget matters has been when a president has taken the lead. In fact, it was Ronald Reagan who in the 1980s took a congressional budget process that was basically meaningless and turned it into a mechanism for restraining Congress, something Congress itself had been incapable of doing. In the area of foreign policy, I think we even see a greater example of this. Discretion is necessary in foreign policy. It always has been, it always will be. It is important that a president understands that and that a president can defend that. Otherwise, you're caught in the kind of crisis of legitimacy that we have today. When he campaigned for president, Barack Obama said he would close Guantanamo, he would have no extraordinary rendition, he would end warrantless wiretapping, and I have a list of about 12 other things. In each of these cases, Barack Obama has followed George Bush's foreign policy approach and practices. In 95% of the cases, he is doing the very things he criticized Bush for doing. The problem is that he's already undermined the legitimacy of doing those things. He has not made a defense, and this is one of the things that I think puts him in great difficulty. Whatever Bush's shortcomings were, and Cheney's, the fact is they at least tried to give a defense for executive discretion on occasion. And they did not say, in effect, well, we will never torture anyone except when we don't tell you and do it anyway, which is essentially Barack Obama's position on torture. Finally, moral leadership. Some people would look at the presidency and say the last thing we want is the president engaging in moral leadership. We don't want President Obama or his wife telling us about the morality of eating at McDonald's. We could just as soon do without it. But I think if you look back to the Clinton administration, you see there's a reason why presidents always exercise moral leadership, whether they intend to or not. When Bill Clinton started parsing words like sexual relations and the meaning of is, the idea that sophistry could replace any kind of meaningful rhetoric was well embedded in the popular mind. And while it's probably politically incorrect to suggest this, I would argue that much of our recent economic problems stem directly from the 1990s in which Bill Clinton told people that words have no meaning. If they have no meaning in terms of sex, they have no meaning in terms of hedge funds and mortgage brokers. And this is a moral lesson we have to learn, and it's the kind of moral lesson a president has to be concerned with teaching us. So in a way, I guess my defense of a conservative rhetorical presidency is very simple, as I mentioned to Steve right before the panel. It's two words, Ronald Reagan. And I think it is a problem if we forget that defense. And I believe it's a particularly timely problem. Because in 1994, a lot of people began or forgot the importance of the presidency. In particular, a man by the name of Gingrich. Newt Gingrich did amazing things in 1994. He made congressional elections into national elections. But if you look at some of his arguments at the time, I think they were ultimately dangerous. In many ways, Gingrich styled himself as a neo-Wilsonian. He argued that what he wanted to do was to create, in effect, a parliamentary system here. He thought that Clinton would become irrelevant as president if he could get the majority in Congress. and that Congress would take over policymaking, and Clinton would be left largely to ceremonial functions. Now, while indeed it is true that Bill Clinton gave the royal family in Britain a run for their money in terms of tabloid coverage, in general, I do not think that Newt Gingrich managed to become prime minister. And I think there are two important reasons for that. One is Gingrich was one person elected from one district. And no matter how hard he tried, he never was able to garner the kind of legitimacy that a president has. Best example I can think of this is the so-called government shutdown. Here is a situation where Congress actually was willing to pass legislation that the president vetoed. But the president managed to turn that into the Congress closing down government. It was, in effect, Clinton who closed down government by refusing to sign legislation that didn't give him enough money in certain areas. This should have been an easy case to make. But as it turns out, it was an impossible case for Gingrich to make, and a very easy one for Bill Clinton to make. The other problem is Congress, given its institutional character, is not good maintaining its focus on the big picture when there's nobody to keep them in check. Here, all I can think of is the fact that many members of Congress came in as ideologically strong Republicans, but very quickly they showed Democrats that imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. Very quickly, they became K Street Republicans and lost any notion of constitutional restraint. So that's why I say today, I do hope that the Republicans take control of Congress this year. But even if they do take control of Congress this year, it's probably not going to matter very much if Republicans don't win the White House in 2012. Thank you.